Hello, and welcome to the Houston Innovators Podcast. I'm Natalie Harms, editor of Innovation Map. This podcast is brought to you by the Pearland Economic Corporation and Texas Citizens Bank. Today, my guest for the show is Ashley Small, founder and CEO of Medley, Inc. Ashley joins the show today to discuss how she grew her branding and PR company over the past decade and how she helps her clients tap into tech to tell their stories. Plus, she shares how, as a Black female founder, she's cultivating an inclusive culture and honoring Black History Month. Ashley, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm so excited to talk to you about all things branding, PR in this digital age. So why don't, just to start, you tell me and our listeners, why don't you tell me a little bit about your career and your company, Medley?
So our company just celebrated 10 years a couple of years ago. It's Medley, Inc. We are a PR and digital marketing agency. So clients usually come to us whenever they realize that they need to, one, reach new audiences, or two, tell their story a little differently. And, you know, with the shift in today's consumer being younger, millennial, diverse, we're seeing a constant need around communicating in fresh and unconventional ways. And so that's kind of our niche in terms of our specific specialty under the marketing umbrella, multicultural, cross-cultural marketing. About 60% of our clients are nonprofits, and the other 40% are corporations who are wanting to tell their impact stories. And so essentially, we tell primarily feel-good stories, human interest stories, stories about how organizations are changing lives. But in terms of myself, I went to school to be a journalist. I went to an HBCU, Texas Southern, and like many of us who went to school to be a journalist, we realized it may be a bit challenging in this climate.
Yep.
You know, the year that I graduated from college was the same year that Twitter rolled out. Mm-hmm. And so I started to see how Twitter was coming for my job because of the internet. And so I was working at the Chronicle. My first job out of school was at the Chronicle, the Houston Chronicle. And I just saw that folks were getting laid off left and right. In this same year, the journalism industry as a whole declined by 50%. Like, newspapers across the country were crashing. And so I started kind of thinking about sustainability. So I started taking contracts on the side, consulting on social media, consulting around PR, even some event management, just trying to create some job security for myself. And that's essentially how Medley was born. Eventually, I was laid off from the Chronicle. Luckily, by then, I'd had a client portfolio, so it was a rather smooth transition while still unfortunate because I didn't get to be a journalist. But PR in many ways allows me to still do that every day.
Yeah, I think it's funny because you bring up, you know, Twitter affecting the news industry so much. But what I think the digital solutions have happened is it's made new avenues for people to tell stories, right? So it's like, you know, I studied journalism and I became a journalist, but I'm like such the minority to be able to, and I don't believe that I'll be able to be a journalist forever. Just the industry is changing so much. But what's important is that, you know, it sounds like you've got to find something where you can still tell people stories. And, you know, that's at the end of the day what journalism is about. So I think that's actually quite like beautiful how it kind of came full circle. And this digital thing that threatened your job at first is now, you know, how you help people tell stories.
Yeah, no, it is exciting. And to your point, I mean, Twitter does challenge us as writers and communicators to think a little more concisely. you know, and then LinkedIn gives an opportunity to tell richer stories. And so it does allow us to still be journalists just in a different way. So I am overall grateful. I'm net positive.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure we can have such a long conversation about the journalism industry, but I don't think that's what people come to this podcast for. So why don't you tell me a little bit about the clients you work with? I know you mentioned them being nonprofits and for-profits both, but the for-profits are showing this kind of humanity of their companies, which I think is fascinating. So what does that usually mean for your for-profit companies? You know, how do you help identify those stories and then communicate them?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the best examples I have are Kroger. So we've been in the Kroger account for about 4 years now. We handle the regional marketing, and they brought us in during Hurricane Harvey, I believe, whenever, you know, they realized, oh, this is going to be a multi-month, potentially multi-year impactful type of crisis. And so essentially they brought us in to help tell the stories around how communities that often go neglected may have access to their pharmacy benefits during the crisis. And so they had a mobile pharmacy unit and it pop up in different communities to help people get their prescriptions. These are things you don't think about. You're thinking about home and food. You're thinking about shelter and food and maybe job. But, you know, people leave everything in their bathroom when they're fleeing from a hurricane. So lots of folks lost the prescription medicine. And so since then, we've been able to work with them around their Zero Waste, Zero Hunger campaign, eliminating food waste while also providing folks in these communities with access to food whenever there's a high need, such as during a hurricane. And so really being able to tell the impact story. So that's an example of a corporate organization we work with. And then we also have a couple of government entities that do really impactful work in the community that otherwise would be untold, in terms of, like, we have one client called the Hester House, which is in fact a nonprofit, but they have a weekly food distribution that lots of folks don't know about, and it happens every single Tuesday morning. Anyone can drive up and get access to free food. And so a lot of organizations are already doing interesting things. I don't think they believe that they're interesting. They've been doing them for years. And so our job is to come in and spot the opportunity to tell the story.
That's awesome. And I think it's funny because you mentioned Hurricane Harvey and helping Kroger navigate that. I'm sure last year you had to help all of your clients navigate a different type of crisis with COVID-19. So what did that look like for you? And what were the needs that you were seeing from your clients?
Yeah, now last year, of course, like everyone, we were pivoting. And so our clients, they did a couple of different things. First of all, they kind of looked at their programming for the entire year. We looked at it together and decided, okay, how much of this just cannot happen because of COVID, and how much of this can be adapted to new technology. Luckily, most of our clients did embrace, Zoom meetings. We're on Google Meets now, Google Events. We're using a ton of different technology to produce client events. So most of our clients' events, we've been able to take online fully. We have one event that involves about 150 people who were part of the program. Mm-hmm. And so that was insane. But we were able to do that. And so it was an annual luncheon that focuses on publishing student authors. So we were able to get about 100 students online and happen to be part of this event. And so that was definitely our biggest challenge over the year. But other clients were doing, like, you know, park programming, virtual town hall. So the other ones were kind of less heavy lifting. But I'm really proud of our clients because they adapted to, you know, how to find the best lighting, how to set up the best audio, how to communicate with new audiences in a virtual world, as well as how to raise money in this virtual world where you're not necessarily asking people to put an envelope in a box. You're committing that they will, you know, click a button and make a donation online. So I'm so grateful that most of our clients adapted, but I'm even more grateful for my team because, as I mentioned, most of us are former journalists, some of us are former graphic designers, but now we're all like video editors and virtual event producers and content creators, content producers in a new way. So I'm really proud. This last thing I'll say is that it was scary at first because I did not know what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. And we did have some clients who had to really think critically about their budget. And so it was scary, but I'm glad we made it on the other side.
Absolutely. I think the 150 presenter events gives me secondhand stress just from hearing about that. So that's incredible. And did you feel like you were, I mean, this might be a leading question, but did you feel like you were equipped to handle all of these unexpected challenges from like a tech perspective? Or was it really like a every day was different, learn as you go type situation?
Yeah, I mean, luckily our team, we've been virtual for 3 years now. So we actually used to rent an office in the Heights, and then it just didn't make sense to me anymore because all of our back office is ran through cloud-based solutions. And so I'm always like, I know there's a software that can help me do this better. Let me go on Google and find out what the software is. And I do that probably at least once a week where I task my team, like, I'm sure this shouldn't be a spreadsheet. I'm sure there's a software that'll help us do this in a more integrated, smart, sophisticated way. I've leaned into that style of management for a long time. And so luckily the technological learning curve was not that rigorous. What was most complex was finding out the best tools for each client's unique needs. Mm-hmm. And so some client may say, you know, well, I want to be able to create an event that allows us to have, you know, a DJ and then five speakers and then a live chat and then a Q&A. And so the biggest complexity, the biggest obstacle we have to overcome is figuring out what's the best technology for each client. And so where the learning curve has been is understanding what all the available resources are out there, and then also understanding how offline experiences really, really, really will help audiences connect online. And that's hard because we're talking about like a DJ. How do we really create a dance-like experience that cause people to get out of their seat at home and dance and talk about it on chat? And so, yeah, so that's been the most, that's been the learning curve, is like really creating that engaging element in the virtual world.
Yeah, that's so true. And it's like about doing something different, because, you know, we've been talking about Zoom fatigue for a while, and it's real and it exists. And if you're on all of these back-to-back video calls, attending an event might not feel different from that. And so making that difference, like, I have so much respect for that. How do you see what everything you've, you know, were challenged and accomplished in 2020 moving into 2021? You know, what's the difference? Is there one, or are you still kind of on this path of continuing to innovate how to approach this?
Yeah, I'm sure people who follow me are tired of hearing me say this, but I have to continue saying it this year. We're really excited about hybrid events. And so, you know, last year we had a client who had an event, and it was an event that historically there was a stage and a musician and, you know, folks coming through and eating food. And last year we completely eliminated all of that and made it entirely virtual. This year I'm telling them, let's bring the stage back. Let's have the musicians. Let's at least have a concert that people can watch while they're home eating, et cetera. So adding like one or two of those big offline elements that may have been exciting in the past, going ahead and producing that and letting the audience tune in from wherever they are. So we're really, really excited about these offline, online hybrids. We just produced the MLK Day Parade here in Houston. And that was a great example, because we had a drive-through donation drop-off where you could drop off donations to give back to the community in honor of the MLK Day of Service. But then we had a virtual programming running simultaneously, looking at parades through the years and looking at some new talent that submitted video for this year. And so we did a hybrid event because some folks didn't feel comfortable driving out and dropping off donations, but they want to still engage and honor the holiday. And so, yeah, I'm really thrilled about like taking some of that offline element and combining it.
Yes. And I think a lot of people are excited for that hybrid aspect coming back and mix it up. I think a lot of people are ready to do that, of course, safely and as things unravel. So we've talked a lot about last year and coming into this year, but since you have been in this business for 12 years, I want to talk to you a little bit about what you've seen over the years, over the past decade. What have you seen within this space, and what sort of technology has disrupted what you're doing? I almost want to say aside from last year, because that 2020 was like 5 years in technology years. So how have you seen the past decade evolve in your space?
I would just say in the PR realm, it is increasingly more challenging to place earned media because we're competing with ads and paid content. And I get it, you know, having come from the print journalism world, I know that, you know, the publishing industry relies on advertising and clicks and, you know, traffic and conversion and all these things, that it makes it really challenging for my stories about, you know, a Fifth Ward nonprofit who's been, you know, saving lives for 15 years. It's not nearly as clickable as, you know, competing with some of these political headlines that we're seeing. And so the industry, it's become increasingly more challenging to secure earned media. And so we really, really, really have to put ourselves in the driver's seat of the everyday person who is looking for rich content targeted toward them, less so than telling the story that our clients want us to drive home. And so it's a constant wrestle with clients around. And I know if anyone's listening, that they probably know that we usually spend some time kind of doing a little dance with clients around, you know, trying to find the sweet spot between what they really need to get across and what we feel like is going to sell to the public and sell to the press. So PR has changed significantly. We lead with human interest more than anything. And then kind of this idea of getting to first, like today on our team call, we do team calls every Monday. And my team was like, hey, we're not doing any Super Bowl memes because everyone's circulating memes about the weekend and the Super Bowl performances. Okay. And like last week we saw, or 2 weeks ago, we saw all the Bernie memes. And so just trying to keep up. And if you don't have someone on your team who's kind of just right there, ready to get the memes out and applicable memes to all your client accounts that make sense for all of them, you miss it. So I think overall, the speed in which the industry causes us to move has made us do our jobs a little differently, but also the way we tell stories as PR practitioners. So all good things. I think it does nothing but challenges, but it's definitely not what I thought would be happening when I started my agency team 12 years ago.
Yeah. Without citing too back into our nerdy journalism conversation for everybody else, I do want to ask, how have your clients been over the years with this print versus digital, you know, transformation? Obviously, I come from a print background and I've seen how important print is to some people. And then you see the future of how large digital is getting and the breakdown. It seems to be like sliding in terms of the amount of content that is produced on print versus digital. But you are working with clients who are used to that. If I can't touch it, doesn't even really exist. So I wonder, you know, how have you seen clients' interest in digital change over the past few years?
I would say, kind of to the point you just made, we have about half of our clients who still want to be in the paper every week or every month and want to be on TV every week or every month. And then the other half who just literally want to see how our efforts are driving traffic to their website, who really want to get into the minutia of it all and look at how it's converting into actual event registrants or how long people are spending on their website as a result of something we've written. And so we do have some clients who, it's split down the middle. The clients who really gravitate toward traditional PR, wanting to see a print story, they are usually looking for building brand credibility. We may have a client who wants to be able to say, didn't you see this in the newspaper, see this on television? I mean, in fact, we did have a client who was in a local news station recently talking about their mission and their service to the community, and they had a really significant donor write a check from them being on television. And so we really do see kind of more the traditional media as the way to still build brand credibility. You know, when an expert like yourself, Natalie, is able to talk about an organization, it really does put a stamp of approval because there's such a respect for journalism. Mm-hmm. So yeah, and then the other folks, I think they are looking more toward how do they garner press and how do they draw the data that's going to help them get more grants or be able to talk about their work in a measurable way to funders. And so it's about half and half.
Support for this podcast comes from Pearland's Lower Kirby District, located at 288 and Beltway 8, a 1,200-acre mixed-use district offering a premier business location with access to Pearland's diverse educated workforce. Learn more about the smart pro-business address at lowerkirby.com. Support also comes from Texas Citizens Bank. Through good and tough times, you need a bank that will stand by you. Texas Citizens Bank gives Houston small and medium-sized businesses the resources they need to thrive. As one customer says, a huge thank you to our friends at Texas Citizens Bank. Great customer service and down-to-earth good people. Call 713-948-5700 to learn more today. It's so interesting. I think I forget, just being caught up in the minutiae of, you know, daily reporting, how, you know, much validation news has for, you know, I'm usually working with, you know, startups and individuals here in Houston. So it's like that opportunity to tell their story when, you know, they're still a small business stage is super valuable for them. And I kind of forget that until they say, thank you so much. I just got contacted by a VC and I'm like, oh, I'm doing things. You know, it's nice, especially working from home, being like, oh, what I write matters, you know.
Yeah, what you write matter. I just recently heard someone on television, they were just talking to a journalist and they were just reinforcing this idea that words matter. And I think it's hard to remember that because there's so much content coming at us, but it really does matter, especially in the search engine world where we go to Google to investigate what an organization does and who they are.
Absolutely. And that is another technology that has evolved tenfold over the past 10 years, where SEO really matters and that becomes a very huge priority. Is that something you work with for your clients and help them out with from their web presence?
Absolutely. And so oftentimes organizations, in addition to coming to us whenever they realize they need to reach new audience to tell their story differently, it's also at a point where they realize that target audience aren't finding them. And mm-hmm. So typically I have a contract we work with on SEO. And we spend a lot of time on SEM too, just looking at, okay, what can we do that's not necessarily getting too granular around your SEO, but just simple things like, how are you talking about your organization on YouTube or Twitter? And some of these things we don't really give a lot of thought to. So we'll do a deep dive or just a surface level SEO evaluation of clients.
So I want to talk to you about Black History Month, since we are talking during Black History Month. This podcast is coming out this week in Black History Month, and you are a fabulous, successful Black female entrepreneur. And so for you running your company, how are you looking at Black History Month and honoring the month within your business?
So it's funny, we just kind of wrote our newsletter on this for the month. We sent out a monthly newsletter, and I told my team, I have one person on my team who writes it, but I told her I really want to write the intro for this, because what I feel like organizations could put more intention around during this month is really giving consideration to the fact that it is Black History Month. And so what happens is you see some brands using this as a month to maybe elevate a Black employee on the team, which is fantastic. But I think what's most important in how we grow is that we really look at the contributions of African Americans through the years. Mm-hmm. And so what we did in our exercise, we looked at who's the first Black PR practitioner with his first agency in 1934. We're telling that story. Who was the first Black journalist, Black news anchor in 1978? Who was the first Black female millionaire, Madam T.J. Walker, and what were the nuances she dealt with in the early 1900s launching a business? And so we really try to take this time to look at the contributions and the complexities of the Black experience through the years and what that means for us today as PR practitioners and business owners, what that means for each of our clients' respective industries, and even kind of drawing parallels between what were some of the obstacles that these industries were being faced with then and now? And what can we be doing to really address, tackle the issues that are still present? And so I want to encourage, if any business owners are listening, to spend this time to honor the legacy of African Americans through the years and maybe draw some parallels about around what's happening right now. We know this past year has been a major year for racial reckoning. And I think, some of the opportunities are beyond talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion and really being intentional about it. And it's really hard to do that without having gone back in history and doing a little work around it. So I love that. I love what we get to do in Black History Month at our agency, because it allows us to look at all of our clients' organizations and see, okay, where's the historical story here and how is it impactful? I mentioned a nonprofit that we work with in Fifth Ward. They've been around for 75 years providing after-school resources, extracurricular activities, senior programming for 75 years in Houston Fifth Ward. And so those are the stories that we like to tell during this month. Legacy, impact, inequity, for sure.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting. I talk a lot about, on this podcast and with entrepreneurs, diversity versus inclusion, and thinking about it less as a box to check, like we are diverse and we have a couple inclusive programs, and making it more part of like the company culture. And it sounds like that's exactly what you're doing in your approach to honoring Black History Month. So for startups and small businesses that, maybe they're only 1 or 2 years old, they're just starting out, what advice do you have for making inclusion and things like how you're approaching Black History Month really a part of the company culture? I don't know if you have advice for kind of starting that conversation.
Yeah, I often hear organizations say, well, we're not hiring right now. So hiring, to me, is the most important thing you can do, is to ensure that there are diverse voices in the room. But, when you're a startup, I know that's always not the first thing you can do. It's something you can work toward. But I would say, even consider who your contractors are, your consultants. When you go to the SBDC, which I work with a lot, Small Business Development Center here in Houston, specifically seek out an African-American advisor or a minority advisor. So maybe they're not on your payroll, but you still have that diverse perspective in some way, shape, or form. I was recently approached by a local tech accelerator, and they're creating like a minority leadership executive committee. They're not necessarily in a position to bring us on as contractors, but they really appreciate our thought leadership. And so I would just say make room for diverse voices, and it may have to be a little creative in terms of how you do it, because it may not just come down to hiring. But my appeal to organizations who are still kind of wrestling with why it's so valuable to have diverse voices, because what we found at Medley is that innovation is actually impossible without diversity. And so what I find, I have some mentees and they'll tell me, you know, Ashley, I just got a job at this organization. And when they hired me, they said it was because they wanted diverse perspectives. And then we have calls and no one listens to my ideas. And they'll reject her ideas. And I told her, I said, well, you're going to have to tell your supervisor or whomever is rejecting your ideas that my ideas may sound a little different. They may be a little unconventional. And that's the whole point. And so I think a part of this is also really, really being open-minded to the fact that you are going to hear things that sound and look different and be open to that, because that is 100% the point.
So that was fantastic and amazing advice. And I think there's been a lot, you know, I think that if you're an entrepreneur and you're listening to this podcast, you probably are taking notes, because that was fantastic perspective. I wonder if you actually, you know, had any general advice for startups. You know, you mentioned hiring as a startup and kind of focusing on diversity and inclusion from a hiring perspective. The other thing startups can't always do is hire internal PR, and even signing up for external PR organizations like yours, it might be down the road. So when startups are really early stages starting off, what sort of advice do you have for making sure they're doing the most in such an early stage when it comes to PR?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. The first thing is to, you know, kind of make sure you have your toolkit ready to go. And I'm sure you can appreciate this, Natalie. High resolution photos, a very succinct about us prepared, maybe even some talking points, maybe even some industry data so you can speak about your organization and the challenges concisely. And so, you know, kind of these key elements that journalists need whenever they place a story. And so I'm naming some of them. I would just say before you pitch to journalists, go and see what they've been writing about to see if they'd even be interested in what you're doing. Twitter is also a great tool. I read recently in Sprout Social that 80% of journalists use Twitter to source their stories. I know my friends who work in news, when something's breaking, they go straight to Twitter to see what's trending and who's talking about it. And literally will ping someone and say, hey, I see you're on site at this, you know, park event, etc. And they'll say, you know, we'd love to talk to you about it. So yeah, I would say take advantage of the fact that journalists are already on digital media looking for stories and looking for sources. So those are the main two things. You know, kind of have your brand toolkit ready. Have a clear call to action and a link, so when journalists are writing stories about you, they have somewhere to point folks in the article. And then the next thing is to take advantage of social media, because journalists are out there looking for stories and you can be right in the center of it. Of course, I'm always going to advocate for hiring a professional, but I know that's not always realistic. And so I would recommend taking advantage of some of the free tools out there.
Do you work with startups on a regular basis? Like, are your clients, I know you have a mixture of clients, but is working with startups something that y'all do?
Yeah, so our work with startups, we have one kind of startup package that we offer is a 3-month retainer, just to kind of get startups off the ground. I think it's really impactful, because often we just kind of do the groundwork, they can run with it. And then we also host workshops, and they are on our website right now. We have a couple of different workshops that can be downloaded. And so that's been probably our most successful tool as it relates to reaching startups, is giving them the opportunity to go back on our website and download those workshops that already air. So I would say those are the top two things.
Well, that's absolutely great. I mean, especially with the startups that I kind of described earlier, where, you know, it's too soon for them to really put the money behind it, but that's an amazing option. So I want to talk to you a little bit about Houston as a business community for you and for what you've been doing. I know you mentioned to me before we started recording this podcast that you've grown your business to 3 offices in Houston originally, but also now in LA and Chicago. So that's incredible growth that I'm seeing for you. But tell me a little bit about, you know, getting started in Houston versus now operating in Houston, and the kind of what the community has evolved as.
You know, I love Houston so much. I'm from Oklahoma, and I love Oklahoma. I'm glad I was born and raised there. However, I always felt that it lacked diversity. And so when I came to Houston, you know, I was in high school and I visited TSU and I was just like floored, and in a good way, by how many people I saw from all shades just walking around campus and walking, you know, the mall. And so for me, it was really a culture shock. And so being in Houston, it's such a diverse city. I do believe it's allowed our company to thrive, specifically with the focus on cross-cultural marketing. And so we've had campaigns that are specifically geared toward Latinx audiences, campaigns specifically geared to reaching the Vietnamese community here in Houston. And so we're constantly being challenged, but also having these great opportunities to grow in our cultural competency, as well as helping our clients grow around that. So I think, I don't know that it would have been such a rich or fulfilling or timely experience in another city. And so when I looked at the cities to grow in, I looked at the other top two cities across the country. LA is definitely one of those cities, in Long Beach, which is kind of right there in the LA area, as well as Chicago, of course. And so we also specifically look at cities where there's a great need for cross-cultural marketing. But yeah, I think two things, between Houston being such a diverse city, as well as us kind of being on the cusp of technology and it being an emerging technology-driven city, is really exciting. We've done a lot of work with our parks. I am on the board right now for Memorial Parks Conservancy. And we do quite a bit of work with the other parks in Midtown, as well as the Arts District. And so watching our city become even more green and being able to be a part of telling that story and why it's important has been awesome too. So I would say, yeah, being a part of the city shifting to looking like some of these major modern cities has helped us grow, and I'm really grateful for that.
It's amazing. And don't sleep on Houston parks. That's such a great part of Houston to be involved in. So I love to hear that. You know, I think that that's something that I feel like we don't talk about enough, how much green space we have in Houston. So I appreciate that you're getting that word out with this park.
Yeah, yeah. And then the weather is so conducive to being outdoors year round. So I love our park.
We love to hate on Houston weather, but when you actually look at it, the time outside we get to spend, especially during, I don't know, January, February, when everyone across the country is holed up inside, we get to go for nice long walks in 60, 70 degree weather.
Correct.
Awesome. Well, I loved catching up with you. It's so interesting to me, everything that you're doing really right at this intersection of, you know, PR and technology, very future facing type work. So I'm glad to have heard your story and gotten to talk to you today.
Yes, likewise. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of the Houston Innovators Podcast. Don't forget to hit subscribe so you don't miss next week's edition, and check out innovationmap.com for the latest Houston startup and innovation news.